It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC coming up a little bit later this hour with more people camping and taking to the outdoors when it can be challenging to be cooped up and safer at home. We'll talk about those pesky critters, our interactions with wildlife, particularly for those that are less experienced in being in nature. We'll take your calls coming up later this hour. But the latest on COVID-19 now with infectious disease specialist at Pasadena's Huntington Hospital, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, welcome back.
Thank you for nice to be back, Larry.
Let's start first with at least temporary halt in a clinical trial in Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine trial because of an unexplained illness. One of the volunteers that's participating in it. We've had this happen before, but let's just sort of refresh what happens now with the trial.
Well, this is a safety precaution. All drug trials and vaccine trials have a review board, and they look for what are called SAEs, or significant adverse events. And they have a whole list of kind of things that they consider significant or insignificant. And so this is a pretty normal process. And I think actually it's rather encouraging to see that although we're really trying to speed up a vaccine release, that these companies are taking the time to make sure that they pause if there is some type of unexpected event that happens with the patient. I don't know the nature of this particular adverse event. The AstraZeneca vaccine was development of something called transverse myelitis. This is a different vaccine. The nice thing about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is that it's a once-only vaccine, but it is a sort of the same platform. It's an adenovirus vaccine, similar perhaps to the one that was in England. So I don't know what the specific event was, but it's normal to do this. It doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccine is dangerous. And I actually think it's actually a good sign that they're paying attention.
And this is typical that a single case of an unexplained illness will typically pause a trial?
If it's an event that has them a little bit perplexed in terms of what happened. I mean, lots of people have a sore arm or a little bit of fever, or they may have a little nausea or some sort of nonspecific thing. This may have been something a little more pronounced that concerned them. You have to remember, too, that these trials are being done with large groups of people. There are 20 to 30,000 people, and you're bound to come across people that have symptoms for some other reason. So that is something that they have to look at. As well. But I think that, like I said, I don't know the specifics on this one, and they're looking into it, but it was obviously enough to make them pause. And I take this as a good sign, not a bad sign, but it is important that they do things very carefully.
Dr. Schreiner, do you feel generally just on, you know, as you're following all these different trials, that the level of transparency is sufficient? Do you feel like, you know, given concerns about the politicization of vaccination, that the companies are, you know, dealing with that forthrightly?
Well, you know, it's sort of an interesting situation, Larry, because certainly the transparency in this administration has been pretty opaque. And it's actually the pharmaceutical companies that have made some sort of novel proclamations that they will present the data and be transparent about the findings and share the data with each other, which, you know, they're all after patents on these things and so forth. So that's pretty remarkable. And they've signed an agreement, the big ones that are doing the vaccine development. So I think they have felt that for the general public to accept this vaccine, these vaccines, if they work, that's the big question. That they're going to make, you know, that the public's going to need to trust them. And I think they sense that there is a great deal of mistrust in sort of the world right now about this sort of thing. There already is a vaccine concern people have to begin with. So it's just so important that people feel comfortable taking this vaccine. So I think it's sort of an interesting situation where the pharmaceutical companies have taken the step forward to be more transparent and not the federal government.
And seeing it in their economic, in their corporate interest, no doubt, as you're saying as well. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner joining us on Air Talk. In the journal Lancet Infectious Diseases, a group of authors, including researchers at the University of Nevada, recount a case of a 25-year-old who suffered two bouts of COVID-19 infection. One of them was confirmed via testing in mid-April. The second was confirmed in early June. The patient's symptoms in the second case started in late May, a month after the patient reported his initial symptoms were resolved. Now, we've had other reports, as I understand it, Dr. Schreiner, of what are said to be reinfections of COVID-19. What do you think of this particular account?
Well, this is not the only one. And actually, there was a death in Holland last week, I believe, of a woman that contracted it again. And they're very careful to make sure that this is a little bit different virus so that it isn't just a recrudescence of the old infection. But it is of concern. And I think that for several reasons. The first is the bottom line, Larry, is that we just really don't know very much about this virus. Even now, we're learning more every day. But it's very complicated, and how it behaves in tandem with the immune system is really critically important. You know, I think that some people do develop immunity, but we don't have any idea really how long that lasts. It may not last very long, maybe 3-4 months, we're not sure. And in some individuals, the immunity may be even shorter. There are viruses that the second time you get them, it's more severe. That can happen, and that may be something with this particular beta coronavirus. But it's very disturbing. It's not very common, but I do think that the length of time of immunity is really a great concern. So even though someone may have had COVID, we don't believe that they should pretend that they're immune because we don't know whether they're truly going to be immune. And so they should continue to do appropriate social distancing, wearing a mask, and the other things that we know work to protect you.
Why does it seem that often the second infection is more severe?
That's a good question. There's a disease called dengue fever where the first time you get it, it's pretty bad. The second time you get it, even from a different subspecies, it can be really bad. And so that's one of the concerns that actually some of the virologists expressed early with this virus. Coronaviruses don't tend to do this, but this one's just a very different beast. And so there is some concern that the second time around, the immune system is set off in a way that's not appropriate, which can happen the first time around. That's why people get so sick with this thing. But the complex dance that this virus does with the immune system is still very difficult to kind of tease out, and immunologists are working quickly to try to understand this. But it may have something to do with the person's own immune system reacting in a very inappropriate way that causes more severe disease.
Infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, who's been with us dozens of times over the past 6 months on Air Talk, answering your questions about COVID-19, which she's so generously giving of her time to do yet again. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, Air Talk page, kpecc.org. If it is possible that someone who has tested positive, even had symptoms from COVID-19, and recovers and can be reinfected, what does that then mean for vaccination? Or inherently, would vaccines provide longer, if not permanent protection from COVID-19? What's different about getting it in the world versus being vaccinated for it?
Well, that's the question, and that's a really serious question, because the truth is natural infection usually confers better immunity than vaccination does. So I will emphasize that second infections are very rare. I mean, there's one or two cases reported. It's not a common occurrence. But also, we're 9 months into this now, so some people may be encountering the virus again who have lost their immunity to it, so we'll see what happens going forward. But natural immunity tends to create better immunity than vaccination. So if the immunity to this virus or any kind of immune response to this virus only lasts for 3 or 4 months, that's going to make vaccination very challenging. And we're hoping at the very least that the vaccine would be something we could give once a year and not have to give every 3 months, because that's a pretty hard thing to do with globally. But that's a really big challenge. And one of the concerns I've had is that the other way we could control this pandemic is through therapeutics. And you can see HIV is a very good example of that, because we don't have a vaccine for HIV, but we have very, very good therapeutics and we can control the virus that way. So I would hope that some of the money that's being spent will be funneled into some of those type of developments because I worry that we're putting a little all of our kind of chickens in one basket here, or eggs in one basket, I guess is a metaphor, for the vaccine. And it's a possibility that it may not work.
Let's talk about some good news here. And hospitalizations are down in California. What's behind that?
Well, I think that's people, I think, got pretty scared, and they should be very scared right now, because Dr. Fauci has emphasized this. I always get a little nervous when Anthony Fauci gets scared, and he's pretty frightened right now. You know, right now we're experiencing a decrease in California. I think people kind of saw what happened over the summer, and they started masking and being socially distant and not having large gatherings and so forth. And that's yes, it's unpleasant not to be able to do the things we used to do, but that's what it requires. And so right now we're in kind of a lull. The concern I have, however, is that as people get a little more complacent, they may start letting go of that a little bit, and we have an uptick. And I think, you know, you have to see what's happening back east in the Midwest. It's really out of control, and they're already starting at a very high level. I mean, there were 40,000 new cases the other day in one day in the United States, and that's just horrific. Europe is also experiencing a really big surge. And so I think we have to expect that could happen here, and that's why it's important for people to be vigilant.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital, infectious disease specialist, joining us. The World Health Organization and other public health experts have said lockdowns don't appear to be the answer in controlling COVID-19. But, you know, certainly we've seen in a number of places, once restrictions were relaxed, that the number of COVID cases went up. So what is your view on restrictions through the economy or people going out and its effect on the number of cases?
Well, you know, I think what has to happen here is it's sort of like a regulator on a hose or I'm not a mechanic sort of person, but on an engine, I suppose, in terms of you have to figure out how much you can open up. Every time you open up a little bit, you are going to get some disease. That's just a fact, because people are not as careful as they should be, and they're going to be close together with people that have coronavirus. So you have to figure out what that magic point is, where you can open up a little bit, enough to kind of stimulate the economy, to get things going a little bit, but not to create too much disease. And for that will vary between different locations and different populations. I think what happens is there's so much pressure on politicians and governments to open up quickly, and people get kind of lackadaisical about stuff, and then boom, we get hit again. So I know that there's been some talk about, you know, just trying to achieve herd immunity. That would be an enormous cost to the world. Millions of people would die to try to do that. And WHO has come out with a very pretty powerful statement against that kind of idea, that you can't just you saw what happened in Sweden. It didn't work. Lots of people died. And to achieve herd immunity for this virus, about 60% of the world's population would have to get it, and that could be just an enormous death toll. So.
We have a listener, though, points out that there also is a negative consequence to the lockdown, that depression and suicides and negative health consequences from people having a difficult time adjusting to this has to also be taken into account.
Sure, absolutely. And you have to balance that. So you have to find that sweet spot where you can open up enough to sort of, you know, take care of people's mental health and their activities and the social behavior that we all yearn for, but not to open it up so much that you end up getting lots of disease.
Dr. Schreiner, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist and frequent Air Talk guest. She's been with us, I think, weekly over the past 6 months, dozens of times, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Now, coming up, I want to hear your story of when animals or insects attack, because I know many of us who have had a difficult time being inside during this time of COVID-19 have taken to the outdoors, gone out, gone camping, been out there in nature, maybe less experienced in dealing with wildlife, with reptiles, with insects, with large animals. So share with us your story of a particularly harrowing account of what it's like being in nature. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 90 seconds.